Exodus chapter 22 verse 18 to chapter 23 verse 33, the 25th talk in a series on Exodus, was presented by David Crabtree on April 2, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 23, Exodus 22:18 to 23:33, accompanies this talk.
And we'll be looking at the last half of chapter 22, and the plan is to do that and all of chapter 23 today. We've been looking at the covenant, the agreement that's being made between the people of Israel and God at Mount Sinai. And there are three parts to the terms that God is laying out for them. The first was the Ten Commandments. Then next are a group of laws, and they are divided into two parts. The first part were laws in which each law is, if this happens, then this is the appropriate resolution. We concluded that section last time, and now we're going to look at the third part of this agreement. And in this third part, it isn't the laws are different in nature. There aren't penalties mentioned. I say that, and then I'm going to contradict that in the first section that I read, but there aren't penalties mentioned. These are things that they are told to do. Punishments are not given. They are apparently left up to the individual to monitor themselves and to make sure that they follow these things. So that's what we'll be going through today. Now, I have said, based on my reading of people who are much more knowledgeable about the laws in the ancient Near East than am I, that these laws aren't necessarily highly organized. That, generally speaking, there will be blocks of laws, but there are extraneous things thrown in, and there's no necessary organization to the blocks of laws that you see written in these law codes. Looking at the first two sections, it appears to me that there is a certain amount of order. It is not always clear why each particular ordinance is where it is, but they are pretty much ordered. The Ten Commandments. It starts out with those commandments which deal with the relationship between man and God. And then it moves to those that relate to man and man. And it starts with the most grievous and ends with the least grievous. The second group of laws, the case law, similarly, it moves through more grievous to less grievous, and it's in a systematic order for the most part. I think that this next section is also more ordered than it would first appear. When I started looking at it, I thought, there's no order here at all. And my Bible reassured me that was the case, because it has a heading in the middle of chapter 22 that says sundry laws, and it has another heading at the beginning of chapter 23 that says sundry laws. So I thought I was on solid ground when I saw no order. But as I looked at it more closely, I think there is order here, and I think the order is important. And the thing that I noticed that steered me in the direction of looking for order is if you look at verse 20 of chapter 22, I'm sorry, 21 of chapter 22, it says, "And you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." Then notice in chapter 23, verse 9, "And you shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Egypt." Very similar statements. And I have noticed elsewhere in Old Testament writings that there is a device that is used, and other people have pointed it out, it's not a new discovery to me, that it is often the case that in their writings they will use what are called an inclusio. An inclusio is where a statement is made, then you have some content, and then the statement is essentially repeated. And what that does is it marks out a unit, a set of material that all goes together somehow. So it seems to me that that's what we have here. We have an inclusio that goes from verse 21 of chapter 22 to verse 9 of chapter 23. What precedes that in verses 18, 19, and 20 of chapter 22 is commandments, I'm going to argue, commandments against serving foreign gods. And we'll see that that theme comes up a number of times, but it is essentially repeated in verse 33 of chapter 23, where it says, "They shall not live in your land," that's talking about the Canaanites, "lest they make you sin against me, for if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you." So that same theme, it starts out our section, and it comes at the end of chapter 23. Okay, based on those observations, I think there is an order here, and I will try to make that clear. If I'm right, then it does have some significance for how this section should be interpreted. And as I was thinking about what it's saying here, I found it both interesting and disturbing. And my hope is today that I will be able to disturb you equally. Okay, so let's look at the first three verses of this section. So it's chapter 22, verses 18, 19, and 20. "You shall not allow a sorceress to live. Whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death. He who sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be utterly destroyed." So we have three statutes here. All of them are things deserving of death. All of them, according to Umberto Casuto, so I'm relying on what he says here, all of them are of foreign origin, and all of them are describing offenses against God himself and are elsewhere described as elsewhere in the Bible described as abominations. The first one, sorcery. Sorcery was common in the ancient Near East, especially in Mesopotamia, but it was practiced throughout the ancient Middle Near East. And it's based on the assumption that there are multiple gods out there and that through sorcery we can manipulate those gods either against one another or merely in our favor through these practices of sorcery. The second one is a prohibition against bestiality. Apparently, there is no other place in the ancient Near East where there was a law against bestiality except in Israel and in the Hittite kingdom. Having sex with some animals was forbidden. And why that is, I don't know. But there is some evidence that bestiality was a part of Canaanite religious ritual, having to do with fertility of crops and that sort of thing. And my assumption here is that that is what is being challenged here, is some kind of pagan religious ritual that includes bestiality in it. Now, I'll point out, the way that I'm reading this passage, there are two or three places where something is prohibited, and I think, because of the way that this is organized, that it's being prohibited because of its relationship to paganistic practices. I think that the argument could be made that bestiality is wrong also on other grounds, but here what's being highlighted is that it's wrong on the basis that it is in imitation of Canaanite religious practices. And the last one, he who sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be utterly destroyed. And I think, once again, I think here this is attacking, in particular, Canaanite religious practices. So the first three verses, then, I think are here because they are all pagan religious practices that are being precluded by God, that no one ought to practice those pagan religious practices. Okay, next section then, starting with verse 21. And you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you afflict him at all, and if he does cry out to me, I will surely hear his cry, and my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. So this section is starting out, don't pick on strangers. And the word for strangers here is ger, the Hebrew word ger, which means a resident alien. So this is not someone passing through. This is someone who is from another country, who has moved to Israel, is living among the Israelites, and is presumably becoming an Israelite, is converting. So that would be a ger. And what's being talked about here is that such people ought not be taken advantage of. And the reason that a stranger would, a resident alien would be vulnerable is because a resident alien doesn't have family there, doesn't have tribe there, doesn't have the kind of connections and the knowledge of the culture, etc., that would allow them to be on a par with any other Israelite. They're at a disadvantage. And since they're at a disadvantage, if someone wants to take advantage of them, then it's easy to do so. And God is saying, don't take advantage of such people. Why? Because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You were resident aliens in Egypt, and you were taken advantage of. That's why you ought not take advantage of those in your midst. It goes on to say, and don't afflict any widow or orphan. So now we've got two other categories of people that are also socially disadvantaged. That is, they're vulnerable. It's easy to take advantage of them. So we've got three different groups of that are listed here, of the kinds of people that are vulnerable, and the Israelites are told not to take advantage of them. In the case of widows or orphans, it points out that if you take advantage of them, they will cry out to God. And if they cry out to God, God will hear them. And there will be punishment for that. And the punishment is going to be appropriate to the crime. That is to say, I will surely hear his cry, and my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword. So it's talking about invasion. So we're talking about an army coming in and stabbing people. And your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. He's going to kill you, and your family is going to be turned into these kind of disadvantaged people. I think then that when a stranger is mentioned here, it's not just talking about those who are resident aliens, but it's using that as a representative of all of those people in society that are disadvantaged, that are vulnerable. And what they're told to do is to be careful not to take advantage of such people in their midst. I think then that the next few, until we get to chapter 23, verse 9, that's what it's talking about. It's talking about the vulnerable in their midst and not taking advantage of them. Verse 25, if you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets, for that is his only covering. It is his cloak for his body. What else can he sleep in? And it shall come about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. You shall not curse God, nor curse a ruler of your people. So now it's going to talk about loans, and in particular, loans to poor people. So I think that the scenario here is someone who, for whatever reason, is in dire straits financially and approaches a fellow Israelite and asks for a loan so that he can get out of this, whatever the financial situation that he's in, asks for a loan. How are Israelites supposed to think about this? And what God says is, you shall not charge him interest. Now, it's important to note, I think, that in the ancient world, they had not yet discovered inflation yet. Money was not centrally minted, and therefore a pound of gold remained a pound of gold for an extended period of time. And we don't have anything comparable to the finding of the New World, where you have an influx of a lot of gold all of a sudden that drives prices up. So in the ancient world, inflation is virtually zero. There are price differences that occur, price changes that occur, especially in crops. But that's mainly dependent upon supply and demand. That if there's crop failure or something, then the price of that particular crop is going to go up. But inflation, as a across-the-board kind of phenomenon, didn't really happen in the ancient world. As a result, if you loaned someone a pound of gold for a year and they gave you a pound of gold back at the end of a year, you haven't lost any buying power. Okay? You've got inflation. If you've got 10% inflation and you loan somebody a pound of gold, a year later, that pound of gold is worth more, less. That pound of gold is worth less. So that justifies a certain amount of interest just to maintain buying power. But in the ancient world, there wasn't that same phenomenon. So what's said is, don't loan it at interest. Don't make money in this kind of situation. Also, if you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets. A pledge was a common thing. It's like collateral. You're putting up something of value that will go to the loaner if you don't repay the loan. And a cloak was a very important and valuable item. People would wear it during the day, but they would also, it was their bedding at night, oftentimes. And what's said is that if you take the cloak for a pledge, you have taken something that is important for that person's life. They need that. And as a result, you need to give that back before the sun goes down so that they can have it when it gets cold at night. That is going to be a pledge that's not kept very long. And so it doesn't work very well as collateral. There are very few loans that are for 24 hours or less. So that's not going to work very well for collateral. So presumably what's being said here is if you take the cloak, you are just taking as a symbol of the agreement that's being made. And generally speaking, in the ancient world, there was some physical act that marked the concluding of an agreement. It wasn't enough to just say we agree. There had to be some physical act that represented the conclusion of this deal. So it could be that the giving of the robe is that kind of act. It's a symbolic act saying, yes, these are the terms that we agreed upon. I will pay this amount of money back in this amount of time. But then, once it's concluded, that cloak is to be given back because that person needs it just to have a decent living. That is a necessity for that poor person. It says, it is his cloak for his body. What else shall he sleep in? He needs it as it's a necessity for him just for to be healthy and well. And if the loaner does not grant reasonable terms, and in particular here does not give back the cloak so that he can keep himself warm at night, it says, and it shall come about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. God will hear the cry, and God will respond. Verse 28 is curious. It says, you shall not curse God, nor curse a ruler of your people. And I puzzled over this one for a long time. But I think that it fits in here, what it's talking about. It's switching now, and it's going to talk about from the perspective of the poor person. The poor person who wants a loan or has taken a loan, that he is not to curse God or the leaders for his situation. Look at Isaiah 8:21. In this section of Isaiah, it's talking about the wrath that's going to come on the people of Israel. Chapter 8, verse 21, and it says, and they will pass through the land hard-pressed and famished, and it will turn out that when they are hungry, they will be enraged and curse their king and their God as they face upward. So the cursing the king and cursing God is a response to their dire situation. I suspect that that's what's going on here in Exodus as well. That it's talked about what the one who is loaning should do. The one that is loaning needs to be careful not to take advantage of the poor person in any way, and not to deprive them of the necessities of life. Because if that happens, then they'll cry out to God. But it goes on to caution the poor people. As you cry out to God, don't curse God and don't curse your ruler. Don't allow that to be your response to your situation. The next section, You shall not delay the offering from your harvest and your vintage. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and with your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days. On the eighth day, you shall give it to me. Here it's in a sense, it's switching topics completely. It's talking about the obligation of people in Israel to God. And this particular obligation is that of giving offerings from their harvest and giving a ransom for their firstborn. When they have a firstborn son, they're obligated to give, I can't remember, it's either one or two sheep without blemish that they are supposed to hand over to the priests of the temple. That's talked about later on. But there are obligations. There are things that Israelites are supposed to give to God at certain times and in certain amounts. And it's saying, do not delay the giving of those things. The thing that is the same between this law and what we just saw about interest paying is a stinginess. Why would one delay? Because they don't really want to give it. They aren't eager to give. Maybe they aren't sure they're going to give, but they're delaying. They aren't doing what was asked of them. They're holding back. Verse 31. And you shall be holy men to me. Therefore, you shall not eat any flesh torn to pieces in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. Now, this is odd. And it's odd that it's stuck in here. How does this fit? Once again, I think that it's talking about a kind of stinginess or acquisitiveness. That if you see carrion, if you see an animal kill that's out in the field dead, if you are concerned about having enough, then the temptation would be to somehow take that meat. Take that meat and use it. That carrion would, in those circumstances, be attractive. But I suspect that this image of eating carrion, for a human being to eat carrion, was probably kind of repulsive to them. And so this becomes an image then of the predatory practices that have been talked about are all like that. They're all kind of like going out and eating carrion. And carrion is suitable only for dogs. And dogs are unclean animals. Don't be that kind of being. The next section. You shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hands with a wicked man to be malicious witness. You shall not follow a multitude in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. What it's talking about here, well, let me read on. Let me read the next 5 verses. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. If you see the donkey or one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it with him. You shall not pervert the justice due your needy brother in his dispute. Keep far from a false charge, and do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty. And you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. and you shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Egypt. This section, I think, is talking about the need to uphold justice, how important it is to uphold justice. And I think that the reason that this comes along is, why would one violate justice? One good reason for violating justice would be to gain financially or socially, gain in stuff. And it's talking about gaining stuff at the expense of someone who is vulnerable. The kind of person that's vulnerable here is, it says, you shall not follow a multitude in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. So the scenario here is one in which there are many people who are ganging up on someone. There is a majority, there's a large group that's ganging up with a false charge against some individual. That individual then is socially disadvantaged. They're being picked on by a group of people that have ganged up on that person. And they are perverting justice in order to accomplish their end. And it's saying, don't do that. Even if it's a multitude, even if it looks like what you're doing is okay because everyone else is doing it, or because it's probably out of fear that you'll be punished by the multitude yourself if you don't follow along. In any case, don't pervert justice to take advantage of someone. But then it gives a caution on the other side of the coin, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. So don't pervert justice to gain, but don't pervert justice to help a poor person. Both are wrong. Both are perversions of justice. Then it goes on, if your enemy's ox or donkey is in trouble, it's wandering away, or it's lying helpless under its load, you're supposed to help out. So the concern for justice needs to be extended even to your enemy. Even your enemy is due the respect of being treated civilly, the way that you would treat a friend if they were in trouble. Again, it says, you shall not pervert the justice due to your needy brother in his dispute. Okay, then it goes on, keep far from a false charge, and do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty. In other words, if you're involved in that kind of thing, that is, involved in a false charge of someone, I will not acquit one who is guilty of that. Don't take bribes, because bribes pervert justice. And then verse 9, concluding the section, coming back to the refrain, you shall not oppress a stranger. Don't take advantage of the vulnerable in your midst. Why? Because you were vulnerable in Egypt and taken advantage of. So that whole section between that, in that inclusio, as I see it, it's addressing various issues of ways in which the vulnerable could be taken advantage of, and it's cautioning against it. It does branch out and talk about some other related issues a little bit, but that's the thrust of the whole section. The next section doesn't completely depart from that, but it is moving, it's transitioning to talking about what is due to God from the people of Israel, how they ought to relate to God. Verse 10, And you shall sow your land for 6 years and gather its yield. But on the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave, the beast of the field may eat. You are to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days you are to do your work, but on the seventh day you shall cease from labor, in order that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female slave, as well as your stranger, may refresh themselves. Now concerning everything which I have said to you, be on your guard, and do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth. So it talks about the Sabbath year, and it talks about the weekly Sabbath. Now the Sabbath year was a practice that was commanded by God, that in Israel, on every seventh year, no crops would be planted. So presumably for 6 years, they would do their farming. And presumably they would store up some food during those 6 years in anticipation of the seventh year, because in the seventh year they plant no crops. The only food that's available is that which comes up on a volunteer basis. Now, interestingly, this practice wouldn't have much of an impact on a nomadic people. So as they're moving through the wilderness, this wouldn't affect them. It's only in a settled agrarian situation where this is going to affect them. But in that settled agrarian situation, that would be significant. That for 6 years you raise crops, but on the seventh year you don't plant anything. And the reason given for that is so that the needy of your people may eat. Well, you shall, yeah. So that the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave, the beast of the field may eat. So the seventh year, what grows in those fields is primarily going to go to the needy and to the beasts of the field. And it says you're supposed to do the same with the vineyards and the olive groves as well. Then it talks about the weekly Sabbath. 6 days you work, but on the seventh day you don't work. Why? In order that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female slave, as well as your stranger, may refresh themselves. So again, the imposition of this Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath, is also has in mind the beasts of the field and the poor. So those need to be kept. Verse 13 then is odd. Now concerning everything which I have said to you, be on your guard and do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth. But I take that to be another warning against adopting the values and the practices of the pagans and the idolaters. The next section. 3 times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. You shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread. For 7 days you are to eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you, at the appointed time in the month Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt. And none shall appear before me empty-handed. Also, you shall observe the Feast of the Harvest of the first fruits of your labors from what you sow in the field. Also, the Feast of the Ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in the fruit of your labors from the field. 3 times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord God. So this is talking about the seven feasts that are to be celebrated every year by the people of Israel. the seven feasts that are commanded. There is the feast in the spring, which is called here the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That's a week-long feast, and that was talked about earlier in Exodus. It's the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread all together. There's also the Feast of the First Fruits. So there are three holidays in 1 week period of time in the spring. But it is referred to here as the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And as I understand it, this goes back to an agricultural feast that existed in the culture of the ancient Near East, was commonly practiced. In fact, all three of these are agrarian celebrations, feasts that were celebrated in the area, and in particular in Canaan. God is saying, this first feast, celebrate that. It is at the time when it's supposed to be celebrated, as was prescribed earlier in Exodus, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. So once again, that emphasis on don't be stingy, don't be acquisitive. Show up for that feast with what you're supposed to bring. The Feast of the Harvest, that's Pentecost, so that comes 7 weeks. 7 weeks after Passover. And that is called here the Feast of the Harvest, of the first fruits of your labors from what you've sown in the field. So the beginning of the harvest then is celebrated, and food is to be presented to God at that time from what is harvested. Then there's another agricultural feast, the Feast of the Ingathering, at the end of the year, so that's in the fall. That's what will later in the Bible be called Sukkot. And there are actually three holidays there that are all at about the same time, and I think being captured by this expression, the Feast of the Ingathering. I think it's fascinating, and I've been talking about this as we've gone through. I am amazed at the extent to which God used the cultural features of the peoples that lived in the area and adapted them for his purposes. So rather than completely transforming Israel in an instant, he maintains a lot of the same cultural features that were already commonplace in Canaan and the surrounding area, but he tweaks it. And he's doing the same thing with the feasts here. I think it's fascinating that he's referring to these in terms of them all being agricultural festivals. Later on, they're going to take on other significance. And the Passover already has been given a different... The Feast of Unleavened Bread has already been given a different significance. The others will slowly be given a different significance as well. But he starts out with just Canaanite festivals. He says, I want you to celebrate them, but celebrate them as I prescribe. And don't be stingy. Bring the stuff when you're supposed to bring it to give to me. Next week, I'm going to talk more about these holidays, because I'm convinced that all of these holidays have a moment in Exodus, in the book of Exodus, that they're referring to. And as a result, as the Jews are celebrating the religious calendar going through the year, they are going through the Exodus once again. They're reviewing it. They're repeating it. They're reminding themselves of that whole process. But I'll talk about that next week, because it's a little complicated. Okay, verse 18 then. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with unleavened bread, nor is the fat of my feast to remain overnight until morning. You shall bring the choice first fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God. you are not to boil a kid in the milk of its mother. Okay, another set of strange commandments. The last one, you are not to boil a kid in the milk of its mother. As you probably know, that's the basis in Jewish practice of not, in one meal, not mixing dairy and meat. They don't eat Big Macs because you've got meat and cheese in the same dish. And so because of the fear that it's mixing those two things as they are commanded not to do. Okay. In fact, in Israel, it's common for there to be two kitchens. One is a meat kitchen and one's a dairy kitchen. We ate at a restaurant. They ask, did we want to sit in the meat section or the dairy section? So that's very common. And that's based on this verse. This verse, and this appears also in Leviticus and also in Deuteronomy, that you shall not boil a kid in the milk of its mother. Okay, what's going on here? I think, once again, and I'm going on, largely it's I'm relying on Casuto, Umberto Casuto, largely for this. But he says that certainly the boiling of a kid in the milk of its mother is a Canaanite practice. It's part of a religious ritual done by the Canaanites. He doesn't talk about the blood. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread. He doesn't talk about that one. But I'm just assuming that that is also some kind of Canaanite practice. The two in between, the fat, nor is the fat of my feast remain overnight until morning. I'm not sure what the significance of that is. If you'll recall, when the instructions were given with respect to the Passover, they were told not to leave any of the meat until morning, any of the sacrifice until morning. I don't know why that is. My assumption is that there's something that indicates a lack of gratitude towards God in some way. That if they are sacrificing something to God and God says it all needs to be consumed, that there's something about consuming all of it that is showing gratitude. And to stop short of consuming all of it is to show less than full gratitude. Something like that has to be at play here. And the other is, you shall bring the choice first fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God. And that's repeating a theme that we've seen a couple of times. Don't be stingy. They were told when they gave the first fruits that they were supposed to take some of the best of what they had produced. And here it's underscoring that. Don't take a random sampling of what you have produced. That's stingy. That's too grasping. Loosen up, relax. Don't be so self-interested, and bring the choice first fruits of your soil as you have been commanded to do. So I think what we have here is a prohibition of two things that are Canaanite pagan practices, and then reinforcing two practices that are part of what is commanded of them in their worship of Yahweh, that it is stressing needs to be done in order to be both showing gratitude to God and being generous towards God because of his generosity towards them. Okay, if that's right, then it starts out in the first three verses, 18, 19, and 20, telling them, don't adopt pagan practices, don't adopt pagan values as your own. And it concludes in verses 18 and 19, saying a similar kind of thing. Don't adopt pagan practices and pagan values for your own. Okay. Now I'll read the rest of the chapter and talk about it in one fell swoop. Behold, I am going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Be on your guard before him and obey his voice. Do not be rebellious towards him, for he will not pardon your transgression, since my name is in him. But if you will truly obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will completely destroy them. You shall not worship their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their deeds, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars in pieces. But you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will remove sickness from your midst. There shall be no one miscarrying or barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion all the people among whom you come, and I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you, and I will send hornets ahead of you, that they may drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites before you. I will not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I will drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. And I will fix your boundary from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, and from the wilderness to the river Euphrates. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you will drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Here is God saying, telling them what's going to happen as they move into the land that God is going to give to them. And God is going to be very generous and proactive with respect to them. He's going to help them in all kinds of ways. He's going to send an angel before them that's going to take them to that place. And they are to be obedient to that angel and not be rebellious towards that angel because he is representing God. He is acting in God's authority. If they obey the angel, if they obey God's instructions, then God is going to make the enemies of the Israelites his enemies. He will act against them on behalf of the people of Israel. And he's going to drive out all of the peoples that are in the land right now before they get there. And he's going to completely destroy them. But they're cautioned, and this is the refrain that we've been seeing, you shall not worship their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their deeds. But you shall utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars in pieces. So don't adopt their practices as yours, their pagan practices and values. On the contrary, serve God, and if you do so, he'll bless you, both what you eat and what you drink and your health. He'll take care of all of those things. And he will extend the length of time that they are on earth. He's also going to help them by sending his terror before them that's going to scare the bejeebers out of the people in the promised land. And that's a good thing. And he's going to make it possible for them to defeat these peoples. He says later he's going to send, where's the hornet? Yeah. Send the hornets ahead of you. It's not clear what the hornets are. That's used in Isaiah as well. Some people think that it is specifically associated with Egypt, I don't know. It could be more generally just he will send his pestilence to go before them and soften the opponent, their opponents before they even get there. I love verse 29 and 30, so I'll reread them. I will not drive them out before you in a single year. Why not? That would have been so nice. But he didn't, and he said he wouldn't. I won't drive them out in a single year, that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. There would be a downside to him just eliminating their opposition all at once. If he got rid of all the Canaanites all at once, the fields would all become overgrown and there would be wild beasts everywhere and they'd have to fight against them. Let the Canaanites help take care of the wild beasts in the fields until you're numerous enough to actually occupy all of the land. So he's not going to wipe them out in a single year, because there would be consequences of that that would be detrimental to them. But I will drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. He's telling them this, it's going to be a gradual process. It is better for you that this takes time. This is done slowly. And he is going to drive them out. They will possess the whole land, but then the caution at the end, you shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Okay. So I think the organization here is that it's talking about the importance of the Israelites staying free of pagan practices, pagan ways of thinking about the world, and pagan values. You need to stay away from those completely. They will destroy you. They will turn you away. That is, to do so is rebellion. I think that's the theme of the whole section. But that part that's talking about not taking advantage of strangers in your midst is in there, I think, because it's describing an attitude that is consistent with paganism. That is, I'll call it greediness, but then I'm going to modify that. Greediness, that is taking advantage of people. Why do people take advantage of other people? Well, I think that they're supposed to reflect on their experience in Egypt. What happened there? They were strangers. And when they were strangers in Egypt, they were taken advantage of. They were taken advantage of to the point that they were enslaved. Well, why did the Egyptians enslave them? They enslaved them, one, because they could, because the Israelites were at a disadvantage with respect to power. And they wanted their labor. They wanted cheap labor. Cheap labor was to their advantage. Cheap labor allowed them to have more wealth. And it's that desire for more wealth that led to the chain of events that put them in slavery. They're to reflect on that and not allow themselves to get into that chain of that chain of thinking. Okay. So greed then is being represented as an idolatrous kind of thing, if I'm understanding this section correctly. Okay, I have a few comments about this section that I thought about a lot during the week and I think very interesting. The first is this Sabbath year, what an amazing thing to ask of a people. Can you imagine if you were asked every seventh year, don't work. We're going to Florida. I mean, that's to not work for a year. I mean, for a first month, that'd be great. But to not have the things that working provides, that would be very difficult. Even if you've saved up, that's going to be tough. In an agrarian society, that's amazing. In Guns, Germs, and Steel, a book by Diamond, I can't remember what his first name is, Jared Diamond, he says something that's very interesting. He says, in a hunter-gatherer society, people don't accumulate stuff because you have to be nomadic. And if you have to be nomadic, the accumulation of stuff is a burden. It's not a good thing. So you need to stay light. You need to have as little stuff that you have to carry around as possible. When societies become agrarian, now they start to accumulate stuff because you can. You can put it in a, you can harvest grain and put it in a storehouse and you can keep it for several years and have it good. So why not stockpile that stuff? Because you might have a bad year. As a result, studies were done with respect to how much time one spends working if you are in a hunter-gatherer society as opposed to an agrarian society. And guess what happens? You work a lot more in an agrarian society because you can store it up. And it provides you security, which is what we all want. And so to have a Sabbath year, every seventh year, you don't work. That is, you don't sow and harvest. They don't stop working completely, but they don't work their fields. That is a built-in damper to acquisitiveness. It's certainly a built-in damper to economic growth and activity. And it's hard to imagine it actually being put into place. People debate whether it was ever actually celebrated in ancient Israel. We don't know. But it's an interesting feature that God would have put in there. The second thing that I want to talk about is the terrible tension that's built into the feasts. They are told to celebrate these three agricultural feasts that were celebrated throughout the area. They were celebrated by the Canaanites. But they're told to celebrate them without jeopardizing the values of the worship of Yahweh. So celebrate these feasts, but maintain your mentality and your values. What a difficult tension to be put into. And yet, that seems to be the tension that God is constantly putting the Israelites in. That tension between being in the ancient Near East, but not of the ancient Near East. That they're a part of the culture, but they're to maintain distinctive values that set them apart. I think it's fascinating, I've talked about this before, that God didn't instantly make the Israelites non-ancient Middle Easterners. That happens over an extended period of time. The third thing is this oppressing of strangers. When I was talking about what I was reading and thinking about with my wife, and I said, this chapter is about greed. This big section is about greed. And I was describing to her why I found that significant and disturbing. And she said, well, greed is something malicious. Greed is when you take stuff to the detriment of others. And she, of course, that's the way we think about greed, and so she's absolutely right. And that's part of what it's talking about here. But I think it goes beyond that. It's not just greed. It's talking about what do we do with financial insecurity? What do we do with the fact that we live in a world where we need stuff? We absolutely need stuff to live on. But the temptation is to go so far with making sure that we've got stuff and that we're secure, that we step over boundaries that God has drawn for us, that we take advantage of other people in one way or another. I've said this before. I am a fan of capitalism. Capitalism is a remarkable development in many respects. And I am influenced by Marx in this. Marx was a fan of capitalism. He looked at capitalism and he said, "This is amazing. Look what it does." But capitalism without a moral base is atrocious. That if there isn't something that constrains that drive for stuff, if it isn't retained within certain reasonable bounds, it becomes oppressive. It becomes horrendous. And that's part of, to a certain extent, that's part of what Marx was responding to. And I think that's really true. And one of the things that I observe with respect to our culture is that base is eroding away. And the quest for more stuff to make me more financially secure has no bounds any longer. And I think about this a lot, and I thought about this a lot this week, that in my own life, thinking about what importance do I put on financial security. And what I always come down to is, but you've got to be responsible. You've got to take care of yourself. There are things that you have to do. And that's true. I don't doubt that at all. But at some point, there is a line that one crosses where it's no longer being responsible, it's being faithless. Now, where is that line? I don't know. I can't help you with that. I think that's the dilemma that we all have to work through. That's what life is about, is sorting through that, where that line is. When have I crossed that? And do I care whether I've crossed that? And it's in that area, and there are other areas where that same kind of phenomenon shows up. And life is just struggling with trying to figure out, where is that line? When am I being faithless, and when am I just being responsible? So I have no answers with respect to that, but I'm convinced that that struggle is critical. To really face into it and think about it and be self-critical, have I stepped over that line, is very, very important. And it will not be solved in a year. It will be solved little by little. Okay, I'm done, and my time is up. I'm sorry I used all my time. Next week, I want to do chapter 24, and then I want to talk about the national festivals and go into greater detail on how those are related to the book of Exodus. Okay, thanks.